Hello, world, and welcome to Real Ramblin', Season 5, Episode 2. I am the host of this Movie Talk podcast. My name is Chris Jovanovic, and I want to thank you at the top here just for taking some time to listen to this episode, and if you are a longtime listener, to everything that's come before this. This current season, Season 5 of the podcast, is a little bit different in structure and vision. I laid that out in the very first episode of Season 5, but I'm going to go ahead and remind listeners, just in case you're a first-time visitor here on this one. Normally, I just kind of go into random movie topics and ramble about them, hence the title of the podcast. But for this season in particular, I decided to take a little bit of a different route and make the focus all season long on directors, early life and career, filmography. And then each episode, I will highlight a couple of movies from that director and just kind of talk about overall thoughts, criticisms, praises, that sort of thing. And so far, I have to say, even just after one episode, I've received great feedback from some listeners and just myself reflecting on it. I have really enjoyed it. I think what I set out to do, I am experiencing, and that's learning a little bit more about, quite honestly, what has been a blind spot for my movie watching experience over the years. And that's just, you know, overall knowing who's behind the camera and why these directors choose to make the movies they do, and how we see their flair and flavor really bleed into their work. So yeah, that's been a lot of fun. Episode 1 was Steven Spielberg, so if you missed that one, the September episode, I would encourage you to go back and give a listen right after this. But before I dive into the director for this episode, which will be Peter Jackson, I want to highlight just a few life adventures from me, and hope that you all listeners will take a little bit of time to pause in life and reflect on things that you've been able to do recently with friends and family. So for me, I've got just a couple of things that I'm reminiscing on now here, and that's did a recent visit to IKEA. I know that might be strange to some to think about just random visits to IKEA. Seems like, you know, it's primarily a furniture store, right? So it seems like just kind of a destination place you go to for practical purposes, right? You might pick up some furniture, bring it home, build it. But for me and my family, it's always been kind of an experience. You go and maybe pick out a couple of things, yeah, but it's more about walking around, taking time to appreciate all of the rooms that are set up and showcased. And then, of course, the food, right? You got to get those Swedish meatballs while you're there with the lingonberry sauce and gravy. And then the less, slightly less quality food that's downstairs in the cafe, get that cinnamon roll on your way out. Over the years, that's been something that, again, my wife and I and my kids oddly look forward to, or maybe not oddly, if you are a fellow IKEA lover. Anyway, went there within this past month, and I've developed a sort of a love-hate relationship with IKEA. I think I still like the idea of going there. But first of all, I do not have one close to where I live in Olympia. Closest one is Renton, kind of Seattle area. And then I believe there's one in Portland as well. So it's a bit of a drive for any IKEA for me. But that's not the primary reason that I am kind of starting to not enjoy going to IKEA. It seems that in the past few years, IKEA is one of those things that has grown in popularity to the point in which it's far less enjoyable. It's hard to find a day, a visit, that's not overly crowded anymore. And again, that's been kind of a phenomenon in the last 5 or 6 years, I feel like. And I guess it's not a big problem. It's a pretty big store. There's plenty of room to walk around. But I'm mainly complaining about the food experience, as I often do. With me, it always comes down to either food or movies. But yeah, the lines, man, in that cafe, trying to get those Swedish meatballs. Not to mention as with everything right now, I guess, prices going up, quality not as good as it was. So I don't know. I think IKEA's got to step up their game. Otherwise, I may not be doing the biannual trips anymore. What do you think? Let me know what you think about IKEA. But something really cool that I got to do in the past month or so, as I was invited to a Hobbit party. I posted some pictures of that on Instagram. And yeah, just what a cool experience that was. Thank you again, John and Lindsay, for hosting And I'm looking forward to that as an annual tradition, hopefully. But, you know, what is there not to love about dressing up and eating foods on theme of Middle Earth and particularly Hobbit lore, and then putting on Fellowship of the Ring and just enjoying. And, you know, this is one of those things, I mean, watch parties and get-togethers where you have a movie on in the background. This is not a new concept, I get that. But it was a beautiful thing to be able to experience, I think, the perfect balance. I think oftentimes when you plan a movie party, it can be tough because as a collective, you have to kind of either decide, are you going to watch the movie and not talk, or talk and not worry about, you know, missing parts of the movie, even if it's one that you've seen 100 times. And I guess to John and Lindsay's credit and everyone who was there, really, I think we struck a really good balance where the movie was the focal point, but conversation, quiet conversation was still had here and there, jokes and all that good stuff. And, you know, nobody was getting irritated at each other, and I had a great time. I think a lot of that speaks to the movie itself, the Lord of the Rings trilogy being of such, you know, high quality and really reverence that I don't think anyone in particular felt like, you know, disregarding what was on and just focusing on the social element 100%. So, like I said, good balance, and I had a great time. I would love to do more things like that, movie-watching, movie-themed parties. My wife and I joked both at the Hobbit party and since then about maybe doing a Matrix party. We're still kind of in the stage of figuring out what that would look like and feel like. And I can't say I'm a fan of the leather, all the leather, but, I don't own a trench coat. But at the very least, kind of getting some ideas for food already. I don't know, maybe some giant prawns, because you got that one weird squiggly thing that goes into Keanu Reeves' belly button. the red and blue pills, jelly beans, that's easily replicated. You take one when you walk in the door, and then the rest of the experience is up to you. I don't know. Anyway, last thing I just wanted to think about with you all out loud, I guess, is just the fact that we are in fall season. In fact, kind of slowly creeping towards winter. At least that's what the weather feels like outside. Fall, you know, speaking of love-hate relationships, first it was IKEA, now it's fall. I just miss the days when both fall as a season and those who love fall were not one big giant meme. I don't think that's fair to people like me who literally have loved this season my entire life, primarily for sentimental reasons, you know, having connections and memories going back to the Thanksgivings of old. Friends, family, cousins running around the table, playing football outside in the leaves. Pumpkin pie, I do love pumpkin as a food. You know what? Sue me. Get mad at me. Call me basic, or whatever the teenagers are saying nowadays. Yeah, I do like a pumpkin spice latte once in a while, and I'm okay with that. I'll be the bigger person here and admit that I love this season. I always will. Can't change my mind. And you can't pressure me out of it. Moving on. Let's learn a little bit more about this Peter Jackson guy. Perhaps you've heard of him. I like to call him the cuddly kiwi. Kind of looks like a cuddly guy you can give a nice big bear hug to. And he happens to be a Kiwi. So that is the kind of nickname that people from New Zealand get. I don't remember why. I don't know if it has to do with the bird Kiwi. Maybe that's native to New Zealand. I don't know. I just remember I've known people. I've been friends and colleagues with people from New Zealand in the past and got that Kiwi thing going on. Someone explained that to me. I did not do the research on that. I apologize. Back to Peter Jackson. So he is kind of another one of these legendary directors. We talked about Steven Spielberg last time, and for Jackson, I mean, his name is up there in that Hollywood Hall of Fame. Yes, largely due to his success with The Lord of the Rings, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but even since that trilogy, let's just talk about him a little bit. So early life, interestingly enough, Peter Jackson was born on Halloween. How about that? Born October 31st, 1961. He was born and raised in New Zealand, as I mentioned, and I learned that the house he grew up in was actually right on the coast near Wellington, overlooking the ocean, his house, and he said that he always felt a sense of adventure just playing around outside his home growing up. I thought, what a fun aspect to think about, too, because, of course, you know, most children love adventure and playing outside, right? But for some kids, that ends up developing into maybe a love and passion for the outdoors. I don't know, being a park ranger, things like that. And then for other kids, you know, you can see that that bleeds into what they do in their career eventually. In the case of Peter Jackson, storytelling, choosing stories that inherently have a lot of adventure. And that's really cool. Peter Jackson shares some formative childhood experiences with those of Steven Spielberg. Again, featured in last month's episode. Go check it out if you have not already. Namely, both of these titans of the industry, really, they got into filmmaking at an early age. Both of them, I found it kind of funny that they got their hands on this 8mm camera back in the 60s, like as soon as they were able to. And I think for Spielberg, it was in his preteen years, you know, late 60s, early 70s. And with Jackson, he started messing around with making home movies on his little camera when he was about 8 years old. Interestingly, both directors also had the eye-opening, life-changing experience of watching a specific movie that really endeared each of them to the degree of, you know, setting their whole life course on this this medium, this concept. And again, I don't remember for Spielberg which movie it was specifically. Maybe I need to go back and check out my previous episode or read about him again. But for Peter Jackson, it was King Kong in 1969. So to those who asked back in 2005, why the heck is Peter Jackson directing King Kong? We likely find our answer in this very formative experience for him. So I thought that was really cool. I admittedly was one of those people questioning the director attached to the project, not because I didn't think it was a good fit. I mean, 2 years after the success of Return of the King, 11 Oscars later, this guy was virtually invincible in 2005. I just always wondered, well, why King Kong? And now I get it a little bit more. But more on King Kong a little bit later on. With early career for Peter Jackson, again, he kind of shared this interesting experience to Spielberg where they went to college for a little bit, but then dropped out and ended up getting small jobs here and there in like studios and small time filmmaking. And I think it was during Peter Jackson's time at school that he developed at least his style and interest. That's kind of this intriguing blend of horror and comedy. And we see that in the very first movie he was able to make successfully, like for profit, that kind of projected him onto his path of being able to make more movies. And the movie that he made was called Bad Taste in 1988. Don't know much about it other than the fact that it was, the concept was like flesh-eating aliens or something, something goofy. And the people that he was working with liked it enough to give him some money for that. And then he would go on to make a movie called Meet the Feebles in 1989. Again, that one I don't know a whole lot about either, other than it was sort of a irreverent kind of puppet, dark comedy kind of thing, almost like a Team America, World Police kind of thing. And again, people loved that. Not what I'm drawn to, but I guess it worked for Jackson's early career there. But I think in terms of his flair for the gruesome, it can most notably be seen in a film that he made in 1992 called Brain Dead over on the other side of the world, or Dead Alive, it was called here in the United States, which was essentially just a straight, like, slasher film in the most ridiculous way possible. There's very little plot to this one, and I do actually remember seeing part of Dead Alive. It was while I was in college, near the end of my time in my undergrad. And my roommates, most of them had already moved out from campus and kind of got their own house. And I was there visiting one day, and I remember this still. Someone was watching a movie in their room, and they're like, "Hey, Chris, come on in." check this out. This is ridiculous. And it was a scene where a guy is literally just like running around with a chainsaw, mowing people down. And like, this was the essence of the movie, really. To this day, I think that movie holds some kind of record for like most gore in a single movie or something. I don't know how you measure that, but from what I remember from the scene, yeah, it was lots of blood and limbs and things like that. So for me, it kind of goes without saying, but I for one, am glad that Peter Jackson sort of changed his path of interest a little bit, or at least the work that he's started taking on as his career developed. That's not to say that you can't still see hints of horror and grotesque in his work, and I'll talk about that more here in a minute. But just moving on to a little bit more of Jackson's filmography and legendarium, just a small list here. Heavenly Creatures in 1994, starring Kate Winslet. That one less grotesque and not yet to the scale of something like Lord of the Rings, but still having an otherworldly feel surrounding this crime-based story. And we're going to see that again with Lovely Bones in 2009. But in between those, you have the Lord of the Rings trilogy from 2001 to 2003, King Kong in 2005, and then The Adventures of Tintin in 2011. This is not Peter Jackson's complete filmography. It's just a few that I wanted to highlight when I think of his most noteworthy movies in the early to mid-2000s, which is kind of the bulk of my movie-watching years, you know, where I went from just kind of watching movies as a kid and enjoying them to really thinking about the message behind movies and how they're made and that sort of thing. Real quick on Lord of the Rings. This is not going to become a Lord of the Rings-based discussion or episode, but I do really appreciate the story behind how it all came together with Peter Jackson at the helm. Essentially, while the idea of bringing the books into live film had been tossed around for decades, really, by the mid to late 1990s, we still didn't have Lord of the Rings movies, and at least not live action. You had the cartoons from the 70s, but it still didn't exist. And so along comes this ambitious director, still fairly early in his career, looking to, you know, put his skills and style to the test, right? And he's quoted from an interview at some point or another saying, basically, yeah, I read these books when I was about 18 years old and thought, I can't wait until these become movies. And I love that, first off, because it's like, you know, who among us hasn't said something like that? You read a book or thought of an idea and, oh man, I would love to see this as a movie. I can't wait until someone makes it. And Jackson's perspective was basically 20 years later, well, no one had done it, so I got impatient. And essentially, well, I did it. I took it on. And I do love that. Now, if you read about the ongoing development of the Lord of the Rings films from a filmmaking perspective as a project, from their inception to getting greenlit all the way to the finished product, you'll be amazed at how much work Jackson actually had to put in, which I think speaks to the high level of quality those films are, whether you enjoy them, you know, personally or not. And I just love that quote, again, of no one had done it, so I got impatient, I did it. I think that can be an inspiring perspective, really, to take for any one of us in life, whether you're in a creative industry or not. I think that's a quote that can also be attached to Peter Jackson's work ethic. I mean, he's become known for a director who, behind the camera, works tirelessly with every minute that he has and makes it a point to connect with the actors and guide them in alignment towards his vision and the source material, things like that. In the case of Lord of the Rings and The Lovely Bones, I think that's seen especially. Lord of the Rings, people, I think, forget that the whole trilogy was filmed back-to-back with only, you know, small, minor periods, holidays, things in between. And I think of another quote that I believe Jackson stated after being asked about the process of shooting Tolkien's ideas. And he said, "You're never finished with a film. You simply run out of time," or something like that. And that's so true. You wouldn't think, really, looking at most of this director's work, you wouldn't think that he makes a habit of running out of time and scraping things together last minute, because his movies are incredible. So I want to take just a few moments here just to highlight a couple of Peter Jackson's movies in particular that I think are really good. As always, I choose, of the two, one that I have watched before and one that I've never seen. King Kong. You know, earlier I mentioned the concept of Peter Jackson being untouchable after Lord of the Rings, and I suppose with anyone at the height of their game, right, the inevitable question becomes, so when are they going to fail? When will we be reminded that they are human after all? I think King Kong, for a lot of people, was a letdown, maybe because of the expectations attached to Jackson post-Lord of the Rings. And I see that as both fair and unfair. I think if you went into this experience, into King Kong, comparing it in any way, shape, or form to the Lord of the Rings trilogy, that's the unfair piece. Peter Jackson's trilogy was lightning in a bottle, and I don't see any movie, honestly, I don't see any movie reaching the same type of accomplishment in the future. Maybe that's my hot take of the season here, but I will die on that hot take hill. I would love to be proven wrong, by the way. Maybe an aspiring director who's early in their career will have an idea in mind, either an original one or bringing an old story new life, and say, well, no one had done that, so I got impatient. I'm going to do it. That would be awesome. Now, the fair criticisms that 2005's King Kong received were aimed more, I think, at how the story played out or some aspect of the overall quality. And that's fine. You know, I remember hearing a lot of complaint around the time of the film's release that it leaned too heavily into special effects, for example. And I think that is a fair criticism and one I believe that will continue to haunt this director again when we talk about Hobbit trilogy, but I won't go there right now in this episode. Anyway, we can talk general criticisms all day, but you know, on this movie talk podcast, what I care more about is finding those positives, even in the middle of a conversation of critique, and then celebrating what we do love in and about movies. So, what did you all think of King Kong? If you have watched the movie, what did you like about it? I personally really enjoy this movie overall. It was in my DVD library for years, back before The Purge, and I remember breaking it out at least once every couple of years when I was in the mood for something epic. And epic this movie is. I love the grand scale. I love that instead of just showing Kong in New York or just showing him on his home island, Peter Jackson told the full story and I think did it very much on brand. I mean, the aesthetic of Skull Island and its Kong worshiping inhabitants, everything from that to the scene with all of the man-eating bugs in the valley thing, there's just an intensity there and just a hint of horror really throughout like the first two-thirds of this film that is just exciting. I like it. I even liked the final act of King Kong when he's brought to New York and he's terrorizing it, looking all over for Ann Darrow, the damsel in distress character, played wonderfully by Naomi Watts. I liked the end, and again, many did not enjoy the last portion for the, you know, quasi-love story or whatever you want to call it. I just saw it as kind of giving some more depth to something that was not as explored in the original. The original was a monster grabbing this lady and terrorizing New York, right? I think with Peter Jackson, he wanted to bring about a case of understanding and sympathizing with the monster, humanizing it a little bit more, which I know has become a bit of an overused trope in Hollywood over the past decade, really. But back in 2005, I think it was still pretty fresh, and the setup there delivers the beautiful payoff in the last line of this film, which is given to Jack Black. Yes, I said Jack Black. He says, it wasn't the airplanes, 'twas beauty killed the beast. I love that. It's just a great line all by itself to begin with. And then to have Jack Black deliver that line after already putting in a really good performance, by the way, with his character in the movie. But overall, King Kong, I give it 3 out of 4 reels in my rating. Not that it's all about the rating, but it's nice to kind of get a sense for where it's at, in my opinion. How about you? What do you think? I want to talk now about The Lovely Bones. Okay. This was a really hard movie to watch. I don't like true crime stories or anything adjacent to true crime. I've talked previously on the podcast about Zodiac, and that was kind of a different animal. I enjoyed it because of the performances, mostly, and the 70s, 80s cop aesthetic. But that scene by the lake is horrifying in Zodiac, and I would not revisit that material anytime soon. And I would say that's probably the case here with The Lovely Bones as well. The synopsis, for those who have not watched this film or read the book that it's based on, is that we follow the story of a young girl who was murdered, and her family's search for the truth and the mind of her assailant, along with his ultimate fate. First off, this is not sunshiny material. And while I won't go into extreme detail in my brief thoughts sharing here, just be aware of who's currently listening to this episode. Thank you. And on that same note, honestly, if you ever decide to let your teens read this book or watch the movie, I would not recommend either to anyone younger than a teenager. But if they're going to do it, I would encourage you to have conversations with them regarding the story and how it plays out. Talk about stranger danger and safety plans in place and all those important things. I have never read the book, but I was watching the movie the other night for the first time, and I got through just the first act alone, which I think is by far the toughest part to watch. And I mean, there are some chilling moments throughout, for sure, but the first part of the movie is terrible. Anyway, I paused it because my daughter had come into the room to say goodnight, right? And I just started talking to her about safety and having her repeat back to me what our family has established in the past about situations with strangers and all this, right? And she's giving me this look like, "Dad, are you okay?" "Yes, honey, I'm just a bit shook up from this fictional thing I'm watching." Anyway, but that's the thing. Even though this is a work of fiction, this book, this movie, it is loosely inspired by countless true stories of terrible things happening, particularly to young women, and bad guys getting away with it because of a lack of resources or an apathetic approach from investigators at that time. We're looking at, you know, 1960s, 1970s, or both. So it's just, it's tough, yeah, and I think it's meant to spark conversation. I think Peter Jackson carried on that goal from the book and added a lot to it here. But where does Peter Jackson come into all this? To be honest, I wasn't quite sure. Even after a bit of digging, I wasn't sure truly what drew this director to this story, other than what I came across was that Peter Jackson said that he was looking to do something on a smaller scale in 2009 after coming off of Lord of the Rings, King Kong, all that. And again, to his credit, I think he achieved that goal. This is no Lord of the Rings or King Kong, but you can still tell that Peter Jackson is painting on this canvas, really. He's got some of those tells. And one driving plot line and setting of The Lovely Bones is the place in which the main character finds herself after death, and it's called The In-Between. As you may imagine, it's one person's vision of a purgatory-like realm. And here Jackson really takes the opportunity to give the audience a vivid, like, otherworldly experience. You have, like, bright colors and images that are seen in this in-between with the main character when she or her family are experiencing joy, and then dark and ominous imagery like gray clouds or old creepy abandoned houses with the front door open. Those are used when, you know, things aren't going so well back in life on Earth with her family. So just kind of some really cool stuff. Overall, even though the story wasn't my favorite, I do think The Lovely Bones, both the original book and the movie, and I do want to go back and read the book now, I think the story serves a purpose in warning us of a very real evil in this world, and hopefully encouraging us to not live in fear, but use a healthy amount of caution in our daily traffic patterns. I think Peter Jackson was the right choice to direct this one. for the reasons mentioned earlier, and I thought the whole cast was brilliant, by the way. Almost too good in some cases. Looking at you, Stanley Tucci. When my wife asked about the conversation I had with my daughter when she came in, later I told her the reason and that I was watching The Lovely Bones, and her immediate reaction was, "Oh, I hate Stanley Tucci." Not I hate Stanley Tucci in that movie, but just I hate Stanley Tucci. We laugh, but I couldn't help but feel the same way after watching the movie. And that, my friends, is the power of good acting. Stanley, I don't actually hate you. We love you. Anytime you want to come chat on the podcast, you are welcome. Just don't wear those glasses and lose the mustache, please. Lovely Bones, 3 out of 4 reels again. Great movie, and I would recommend it. Just read the room, people. Make sure you've got the right audience for it. And if you are sensitive to certain kinds of material like what's in Lovely Bones here, just be aware of that as well. It was tough, but really good, if that makes sense. All right, but with that, I am going to wrap up for the second episode of Season 5 of Real Ramblin'. Thanks for joining me on the journey. And thank you, Peter Jackson, for going a little more mainstream in your filmmaking and for giving 100% every time. Thank you for mastering the art of just a touch of tasteful terror blended with the ability to transport audiences to other worlds. Hey, if you want to chat with me about movies, audience, you can find Real Ramblin' on social media at Real Ramblin' or send an old-fashioned email to realramblin@gmail.com. That's realramblin@gmail.com. Don't forget to catch other episodes of the podcast on Google, Spotify, and other platforms. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep watching and loving movies, and keep on rambling. Bye. Thank you.